Is it my statement or something?
Oh, cool. Well, that's good to know.
And I was like, where's the computer?
Sorry, Your Honour.
Oh, sorry.
I'm just mindful the Director General presents the case next.
Yes.
I was thinking we might be on tomorrow, but I'm noting we've got about another 6 or 8 experts for the council.
Well, indeed. I was going to ask Council how they thought we were going. It did seem to me we were possibly going more slowly than we thought we might be. Mr. Conway, what's your take on rate of progress?
It is for yours, Your Honour. I'm anticipating we'll have Mr. Brock's up on next.
Yes.
And there may be some questions for him on farm systems. I would anticipate we get through by the end of tomorrow. We might be on to Mr. Trebilco, but really, obviously, it depends on the extent of questions. And I imagine there may be quite a few for Mr. Trebilco, so I would envisage we can confidently state he'll go into Thursday and may take up a large amount of Thursday.
So I don't think you're likely to be starting before sometime on Thursday.
Thank you, Your Honour. I'm mindful that we have 7 experts, 4 of those are AVL.
Yes.
And mindful that only Auckland has AVL.
Yes, I know. And we'll have to see what we might do in relation to that.
Thank you, Your Honour. I just wanted to check because I have an expert about to jump on a plane. I'll ask him to delay that and to come tomorrow for Thursday.
Oh, I see. Yeah. To travel to here. Yeah, no, I think he can delay this flight, certainly.
Thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you very much. All right. No other housekeeping matters? Thank you, Commissioner.
Good afternoon, Dr. Strasbourg. Good afternoon. Unfortunately for you, I do have quite a number of points of clarification. And I'd just like to give you a little bit of background as to why I'm asking for them, so that it will help you, hopefully, to help me. As His Honour noted yesterday, we are coming up to speed. We've had around 120 briefs of evidence and joint witness statements, ranging from 5 to 327 pages long, and often addressing very complex issues. So you, as you can see, it will take us a little while to get totally on top of the case. As I also said, we've been assisted by the fact that a number of us on the British court have been involved in similar cases, and quite a number of them now. So we still have to understand the local environment, and I'm not looking for detailed answers to my questions. I want to just get a proper understanding without going into too much detail. In terms of the evidence, I'd like to acknowledge and thank the Pukekohe Vegetable Growers Association, whose evidence, seven briefs of evidence, range between 5 and 11 pages. And I felt a great feeling of relief each time I opened one that was of that length, compared to the times when I read one, opened one that says 100, 200 or 300 pages. As you'll be aware, the NPSFM requires us to use the best available information. And as water quality is a fundamental driver of PC1, that's why I'm seeking quite a number of clarifications. It is clear from the evidence that reductions in all four contaminants will be required, but it is equally clear that time will be required to achieve that, and getting the balance right will be very important. And I make that as a general comment, because one of the things we're concerned about is if we push people too hard, they're just not going to try. And so we do need to try and make sure that we're realistic in our expectations of timing. And as one example of that, where the court has addressed this issue, and Mr. Matheson and Mr. Thompson will be aware of it, is in the case of the Te Waikura Kupu Springs Water Conservation Order, where we it's a recommendation to the Minister, and the court found that there was a requirement to reduce nitrogen levels by around 10%. But we worked with federated farmers, or the farming community rather, and other parties to the hearing to try and work out something that was sensible. And in that case, the date for compliance was, I think it was 2038. And that was, so we do need to be realistic in the time frame, as you said. That's something we'll be looking at very carefully for this particular case. And just as a matter of interest for people, Te Waikura Pupu was a situation where it was a very confined catchment, and there were a limited number of outlets for the water from that catchment. So we had excellent monitoring information, thanks to a local community group, and that enabled us to understand the catchment and influences quite well. And climate was a very big influence on nitrate levels reaching the springs. And I think the 10-year cycle that you mentioned was borne out there. And so it's something that we just need to keep in mind in this case here. In terms of the clarifications, I'll start on those now. I'm just wondering what information the council has on total nitrogen discharged in the form of nitrate in the Waikato and Waipa catchments. I noticed that in the MFE information, or the Parliamentary Commission, one or the other, they've got that information for most regions apart from the Waikato region. So I'm wondering if that information does exist.
So, Commissioner, you're asking what percentage of total nitrogen is made up by
the nitrate
form. Nitrogen. That's a good question. I think there is a figure in my evidence. If I can direct you to figure 6.3, which is just following paragraph 78 of my evidence. This sort of might help to some extent.
After paragraph, what was it, sorry?
So, after paragraph 78 of my evidence in chief, there's a figure 6.3, and that's taken from a book that was published called Waters of Waikato. So, it's about the Waikato River, and this information shows, if you look at the second panel on the left for nitrogen, there's the dark line. So just to explain, along the x-axis is the distance downstream, and along the y-axis is the nitrogen concentration. And the black line is for total nitrogen, and the open circles with the dashed line is the dissolved inorganic nitrogen, which includes both nitrate, or includes several forms of dissolved nitrogen that are immediately available to plants for growth.
Okay, so I didn't pick that figure. I told me that. I can see it says it in the
So yeah, so you can see from that figure that roughly 50%, I think, of the total nitrogen is in those dissolved forms, including nitrate.
That answers my question. And the reason for asking is that is I'd like to understand what the current understanding of the council is in terms of load to come in terms of nitrogen.
Yep, a very good question. So just for context, load to come relates to essentially the nitrogen that may have already been lost from the land surface and is moving its way through soil, the vado zone, and into the groundwater zone before reaching surface water. Probably 10 years ago, or probably a bit less when PC1 was being formed, there was quite a lot of evidence that the groundwater lags were on the order of decades. So particularly in variation 5 to the plan, which dealt with Lake Taupō, those groundwater lags were identified as being quite significant. So it means that what we're measuring in the stream now isn't a direct reflection of the current land use. There's a load to come, a lag. So if we reduced land use intensity now, it would take quite some time for us to see the effects of that in the monitoring in the river. Over the last 5 years or more, there's been a major research program being undertaken by Aqualink and others looking at it's called the Critical Pathways Program. So it was funded by MBIE, the Ministry of Business, etc. Innovation and Employment, thank you, Commissioner. And what that research showed was actually there were faster pathways. So there's a mixture of pathways for nitrogen to get into rivers, and there's not necessarily any one dominant pathway, it's a mixture. And the importance of shallower or more rapid pathways, I think, had been underestimated in the past. So that research now suggests that that load to come is less, so the lag time is less. And apologies, Commissioner, you had just asked me to keep things brief, but it's sort of as brief as I can make it.
I have no problem in you making things clear to people who are not familiar with this topic. And I think that's, expressing things in language that people understand is important, so please don't apologise for that on my behalf. No, that's helpful. So basically what you're saying is there is a relatively rapid path that enables a proportion of the nitrogen to get into the environment relatively quickly.
Yes.
And there is a proportion that comes through the deeper section that will still take possibly decades to come out.
That's correct. There's also deeper groundwaters tend to have low oxygen. And in low oxygen environments, that nitrogen is essentially converted to nitrogen gas. So essentially you'll see very low levels of nitrate in deep, old, low oxygen groundwater. So there's also another pathway where some of that nitrogen is likely to be lost from the system.
And that was actually an interesting issue in Rotorua, where
contrary to my expectations, there was quite high oxygenated water in quite a number of the catchments, and so the denitrification was not occurring. And do you think that's a possibility in the Waikato region or not?
Again, the research that I mentioned, certainly in the upper Waikato around the Riparoa Broadlands area, the geology there, there's obviously a lot of volcanic eruption material, lots of pumice and ash from eruptions. And in some places that is covered over old forests, and those old forests are areas where there's essentially denitrifying zones in the groundwater. So if the water travels down and into those zones, the nitrogen is likely to be lost to the system. Because of that, those buried forests.
Yeah, I saw that in the evidence of buried forests, but that would be a relatively localised issue?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. That's good. Now, I really want to get a good handle on the relationship between PC1 and future plan changes, so that in setting direction through PC1, we're not inconsistent with where the council's thinking is on how to move forward from here. And so one of the issues is knowing at what point, if at all, does the council envisage setting limits on nitrogen loss from individual farms, because I think it's important that everyone understands that so they can get it into their thinking, and it will certainly help me, and I imagine other members of the court, to have an understanding of that. So this is where my next series of questions are going to. Based on your current understanding of the nitrogen attribute state to be achieved by in 80 years, by how many tonnes and by what percentage of the total will nitrogen have to be reduced over the 80-year period? In other words, if it's 1,000 tonnes going in now, what does it have to get down to by the end of 80 years?
That's a very difficult question. There is, and I think Dr. Asale's evidence for the River Iwi presents the percent reductions required, and I'm trying to think the sort of levels of reduction required over 80 years. I think it's, I don't think I can be specific about an actual figure, Commissioner. Could I say that with PC1 we have total nitrogen targets along the main stem of the river, and as been pointed out by others, there are targets associated with attributes relating to the toxicity of nitrates, and I'm sure you would have heard about that in the Waikoua Court of Kukui Springs.
Yes, yes, sure we did.
Yes. So the NPSF in 2020 requires us to define nutrient exceedance criteria for nutrient-sensitive water bodies, essentially. And in many cases, the levels of nitrogen set under for those nutrient exceedance criteria are going to be more stringent than the current PC1 nitrogen targets. And so that makes it difficult to sort of determine what sort of levels of change is needed.
Just to explain, I did ask you on your current understanding of the attributes you have now, not the ones you're going to set. You've got on to my next question.
Oh, okay.
I'm just trying to understand, based on PC1, what PC1 can do,
yes,
what's expected. Like, say, for example, it's a 30% reduction for argument's sake. And my next question was going to be, and with the work you do in terms of protecting the ecosystem health, there's likely to be a further reduction required. Would that be a fair statement?
It is, yes.
And I wasn't asking you to predict that for me.
Right.
But my question there is that, and you just answered it, that there will be a further reduction. So whatever we're able to do in PC1, there must be an expectation that either as part of the 2024 plan change, which I call change or one soon after, there would have to be a further reduction. Would that come down to the level of detail where individual farms would have to meet reduced nitrogen targets?
Allocation to a property scale was very much considered in the development of Plan Change 1.
Mm-hmm.
And in relation to achieving the long-term 80-year targets, the expectation was that property scale allocation would be needed in the future. That property scale allocation wasn't considered as part of PC1, but the fundamental building blocks of that were included in Plan Change 1. And we've talked about that earlier on today, which is primarily understanding where everyone is at now in terms of having good property scale information on current practice and also the levels of change people are able to implement over the next 10 years. So, but there's a recognition that we will at some point need to go to that property scale allocation. Well, that was what was envisaged and when Plan Change 1 was developed. Part of that, if I may say, is going back to Judge Williams' earlier questions, part of that was understanding the negotiations still to come between the Crown and iwi over iwi rights and interests in water, and there was always expected that there would be some form of allocation for those iwi rights and interests in water. So again, that wasn't considered in the 10-year lifespan of Plan Change 1, but was expected to need to be incorporated in future steps along the path to that 80-year target.
You're being very helpful, because that's what my expectation would be from the evidence I've read, but I wanted to make sure that I wasn't putting my own interpretation on anything, so that's very helpful, thank you. Now, in terms of the 20% reduction to be achieved in nitrogen, I'm only talking about nitrogen for the moment, you've made reference to a study of 700 farms in the Upper Waikato East FMU, and that achieved, 8% reduction in nitrogen.
Yes.
Where's the other 12% likely to come from in the first 10 years?
So just to clarify, the 20% that's in Plan Change 1 at the moment is a 20% closing of the gap between current and future. So it's not a 20% reduction in nitrogen, it's 20% of the gap. And in some subcatchments, that gap is very small. In other subcatchments, that gap is quite large, which is why I referred to Dr. Olsale's evidence, because I think he's gone into quite some detail on the percentage reductions required. And I can't think of the figures off the top of my head. But my understanding is looking at those figures for the lower Waikato, which of course is sort of that, in terms of cumulative effects, is seeing what's happening in the catchment as a whole. The requirements for reductions in the lower Waikato were around, or were consistent at least with the levels of change that we saw in that Upper Waikato Sustainable Milk Plan project, so those 700 farm plans, so about 8% per nitrogen. And I think about 18%, 16% for phosphorus.
Yeah. Okay.
So those were in the absence, so they were essentially sort of voluntary change on those farms. But having said that, we made the argument that it was very much worth those farmers making those changes ahead of Plan Change 1.
Okay, so just to make sure I fully understand that, what you're saying is that if the same practices on dairy farms implemented in the Upper Waikato FMU are implemented throughout the PC1 area, you're likely to get very close or possibly achieve your nitrogen reduction targets in the 10-year period.
there was in looking at those targets for the lower river, for total nitrogen and total phosphorus, in knowing what had been achieved with those 700 farm plans, that gave me some degree of confidence that we were at least in the right ballpark.
Oh, that's good. That's again very helpful. Thank you. Quite a few dairy farms calculate their nitrogen losses based on wintering stock off the milking platform. How is the nitrogen loss from the areas off farm where they're wintered, how is that accommodated in PC1?
It's a very good question. I think again, one of our farm systems, Mr. Brockstock, who follows me, might be able to answer that better. But if we're looking at an individual property being able to assess their level of nitrogen loss risk, then generally the wintering off of stock, if you like, would be seen as a reduction in nitrogen risk for that property, and that where those stock went for the winter, would their nitrogen risk would reflect the fact that they were bringing stock on in winter. So at a catchment scale, that can be quite challenging because you're certainly moving nitrogen around, you're not actually reducing nitrogen. So that needs to be taken into account when you're looking at where that risk is across the catchment and what practices you might need to control to reduce the impacts of that.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of this from a consenting point of view. Because your farm, we've got a basis for requiring a consent. What's the requirement to require to have a consent for a wintering off paddock, for example?
I'm not sure if I can answer that, Commissioner, in terms of the detail.
Okay, that's fine. But it is an issue that's concerning me, because in a number of cases there have been situations we winter off-site, and it's left at that. But the nitrogen is still going somewhere. So if Mr. Conway, you could ask the correct expert to address that, I'd be very grateful. Thank you. And coming now to the nitrogen scorecard, there could be several of these, but looking at the one for nitrogen for the Fonterra risk scorecard, for example, do you see that being the basis on which future reduction in nitrogen would be measured?
That would be one tool. I've got limited knowledge of the Fonterra tool. I was working at Fonterra when it was first developed, so I have limited knowledge of it. We need robust nutrient management tools on farm, and Overseer has been used extensively throughout the country for many years, including here in Waikato and Variation 5 in Lake Taupō. There is the Fonterra risk scorecard. There's also MFE's nitrogen risk index tool that I've been involved in the development of, which is still very much in a prototype. From a regional sector perspective, the uncertainty of how we measure nitrogen loss at a property scale, I think, is a significant constraint to managing the effects of farming on the environment. And I'm hopeful that as Overseer, the redevelopment work that's going into Overseer advances, and also development and testing of tools like the Fonterra tool and the MFE tool and other tools sort of progresses, that we build that confidence. So I think it's going to be very, very difficult for us to manage nutrient loss and nitrogen loss in particular without confidence in those tools.
Okay, so you've mentioned a few tools, but there's also the CVP tool that's been developed. There's one I've seen for stock management, dry stock, even though it wasn't developed by the dry stock people. So what I understand you to be saying, there is still considerable uncertainty as to how that will be done at the time there is a need to actually set on-farm production levels. Is that a correct statement?
Yes. So you need your best available information. So we could go with whatever tools we have available to us. Overseer is available, but clearly the guidance is restricting the use cases of Overseer. There are other tools available, and there's been quite a lot of discussion amongst the parties about those other tools that might be available. We absolutely agree that we right across the country, regional councils need these tools and need confidence in these tools to be able to apply them to improve the outcomes around nitrogen.
I fully understand, I can assure you. But that leads me on to how we deal with this issue between Overseer and Alternative. And certainly my reading of the MFE position is that they're not ruling out Overseer altogether. It could be used in conjunction with other tools, a multi-investigation line approach. And to be quite honest, that was used at Te Waikarapuku. Obviously, it was not, in my view, the main tool. It was one that we just used to see if it made sense from that point of view. So what I'd like parties to consider is that if we had to go through a Section 293 process, we're probably looking at another 6 months before you get a decision from the court. And one option to consider is that we leave it quite flexible, that the tool to be used is still to be determined for the purpose of load reduction and could be any one of a number of different options. That's not saying Overseer will be used, but it does leave that option. So I'm just putting that out there in terms of something that may help us to get PC1 operative sooner and get the improvements underway, rather than go through a Section 293 process. Not saying that should be the case. I'm just putting it out there so you can address it when you come back to it. Having addressed the one of the things that will have to be decided, whatever tool is used, there will need to be a start date from which reductions are achieved. Is the regional council's current thinking that it should be the 2016 or 17 date of notification, or should it be something that can be measured with much greater certainty now because of the better information available? Are you the right person to answer that question?
I'm probably not the right person to ask that question, Commissioner. I think perhaps Mr. Smith or Mr. Trevilco.
Okay, that's fine, thank you. In terms of phosphorus sediment and E. coli, there doesn't seem to be any tool that's being talked about as a means of measuring reductions in those at either a catchment or a farm level. Do you have any views on that as to how that's going to be addressed?
It's a perennial problem because in developing the MFE risk index tool, it was clearly identified that we need a risk tool for all four contaminants. Mm-hmm. So that was the advice from the regional sector to MFE. In terms of developing the tool and the first version of their tool, it was, I think, appropriately, they said, well, let's start with nitrogen because nitrogen is something we know most about in terms of measuring that risk. And so we end up with, you know, the need for a tool that assesses risk in relation to all four contaminants, and then we end up with a tool that's still going to be a prototype around nitrogen only, and then a lot of additional development work will have to be invested in that tool for nitrogen, and we'll be still left with no tool that deals with those other three contaminants, even though in my view that would be the most useful risk assessment tool would be that one that deals with all four. But
I'm sure that we
it's, not in, the, it's not in the near future, sorry.
Okay, well, that's good, thank you. I'd just like to understand where the council's thinking is on the incorporation of Mataranga Māori. It's not in PC1. But is that something that will be brought in at some stage in the future?
Yes. And from a science perspective, we're making first steps into trying to build bridges between environmental science and Mātauranga Māori, and have hired a young scientist in that space. I think Judge Williams referred to this on the first day, the whole values around mahinga kai, for example, and understanding what and where and how much is appropriate. PC1 in the early days considered some attributes around mahinga kai, but none of those made it into the notified version of PC1. The NPSFM also doesn't have any attributes directly relating to mahinga kai, so that remains a significant gap, despite the fact that it is a key requirement of Te Tiri Whaimana. So it is a recognised gap. We are slowly looking to build that, to fill that gap.
Just as another observation, the Southland Expert Conferencing on Water Quality, which Mr MacArthur was heavily involved in, that went on for 10 days and was joint conferencing between Western science experts and Mātauranga Māori experts. And I found it a very, very useful situation to be in, to have both experts discussing it in the same room, because it was when Te Mana o Te Wai was first coming out from Kiu Te Kitai, and we were able to get an explanation that from a Mātauranga Māori point of view that was helpful in guiding future work. And similarly in Te Waikarapuku, we directed joint conferencing of Mātauranga Māori and Western Science. So there are some examples to look at, and I'm sure there will be others, because that's quite important. A very simple question now, and I don't expect an answer now, but I'd like if you could provide information at some stage. In your various graphs showing the levels of contaminants at different distances down the river, would it be possible to indicate where each of those locations is? They're sort of so many kilometres down.
Yes.
But without getting going for a long walk and measuring it out by pacing or whatever, it'd be really good if you could just give us an indication of where those monitoring sites are, just so that we can orientate ourselves. I'd like to come back to the issue of dissolved oxygen as an interim target attribute, and there's been quite a bit of discussion on that. My question is, how significant would it be if it is not included in PC1 but is included in the 2024 plan change? Do you have a view on how much difference it will make in terms of benefiting the environment?
I think we are looking to we are in the process of expanding our monitoring of areas where we expect to see dissolved oxygen problems. So that is both reflecting the requirements of the NPSFM, but also our increased understanding of dissolved oxygen as an issue in the region, and the fact that we haven't done a good job of monitoring in the past. So from a monitoring perspective, it probably makes no difference because we've got those plans in place already. In terms of the sorts of things that we might be able to direct through farm plans, farmers could make some changes in the next couple of years that might have beneficial effects on dissolved oxygen. And there is potential for shading of waterways and some other measures that might directly benefit dissolved oxygen through the farm plan pathway. So as soon as PC1 is underway with those farm plans, so that would be an area where there'd be potential for more rapid responses. Whether that requires dissolved oxygen to be in PC1 or not, I'm not sure.
Could be done either way, I would have thought.
Yes, so I guess again, so long as there's clear direction to those helping farmers develop farm plans, that in areas where we think it's a key issue, that dissolved oxygen should be considered when farmers are thinking of their mitigation actions.
Okay, that sounds good. And you, in your discussions with Ms. Ongi this morning, you were talking about the monitoring program. How certain can the court be that that will actually happen?
So two scientists who are working on the dissolved oxygen attribute directly. One has plans in place to deploy dissolved oxygen monitoring loggers in several locations this summer. So we'll be collecting data in the Whangarino and several other lowland areas of the Waikato this summer. And that goes alongside more sort of modelling work that the other scientist is involved with to try and understand where our most at-risk areas are. So that work is built into this year's program of work. So hopefully that gives the court some confidence that it is work underway and not simply a promise.
Okay, thank you very much. That's good. At 78 of your evidence, 78 of your evidence in chief, you mentioned an increase in TM and TP at Narawahia coming from the Waipa River. And at 50, you include a table of attributes selected by the CSG. And I'm just interested in why a phytoplankton and total nitrogen and total phosphorus issues in the Waikato River, but not the Waipa.
It comes down to the retention time. So the decision was made that to use the lake attributes from the NPSFM 2014 as it was at the time. So TNTP and phytoplankton are attributes relating to lakes. The Waikato River is a lake-fed river, so it has reasonably stable flow compared to many other rivers. And then the series of eight hydro lakes down the river also increase the retention time. So certainly that upper in the upper Waikato FMU, the river is functioning in many ways like a lake, so it has increased residence time. So in that situation, TN and TP and phytoplankton is a measure of the how enriched the system is and how much algae is growing in the river. The Waipa, in comparison, in its upper reaches, is probably more likely to grow very fine, so attached to algae on the bed of the river, and then the lower part of the river is very much light, limited, and highly turbid, but doesn't have that long retention time.
I'm interested in your comments about E. coli and 140 of your evidence in chief. You talk about ruminant and avian pollution detected in almost all samples, but no human pollution was detected. I found that quite interesting considering there's some sewage waste after treatment going into the river. Do you have an explanation for that?
No. It was a surprise. that there was no human, because several of the sites were peri-urban, so would have had areas of stormwater runoff and also potentially potential septic tanks or things in several rural areas in those catchments. So it was certainly expected, and which is why we included human markers in that analysis, but so it was surprising. So I know from work done, and certainly in Auckland here, that often human sources of fecal material are found in stormwater, and often associated with crossovers between sewage systems and stormwater systems. But at those sites we looked at, it was primarily a ruminant and an avian bird sources.
I'd now like to come on the rather topical subject of the McDowell paper. And I did read it last night, and I can understand the issue of lower order streams potentially causing more contaminants to be discharged. But I have to say that I would need to ask even more questions than I've asked you of the authors before I'd have any ability to say, yeah, I understand what you're saying, because it is quite a technical paper. There are a large number of assumptions made. So I certainly accept the fact that there's likely to be an increase in contaminants, but whether it's 77% or not, I'll be able to say that at this stage. So the issue of streams is a really big issue, and when fencing is required. Because I think based on your evidence, there's 17,000 kilometres of tributary streams in the Waikato. That would be 34,000 kilometres of fencing. And if you took it at even $15 a metre or something like that, that's probably $500 million or something like that. I'm not sure if my math is correct, but it's an awful lot of money.
Yes.
And so setting the right time frame and setting some guidelines on which streams do need to be measured is a really critical issue. And this is one area where I believe that if we go too far too soon, farmers would say, I have no chance of affording that, so why should I bother? And so my question of you is, where do you think the money should be spent first? Which order streams? Or are you not the right person to answer that?
I referred, Commissioner, to the a figure in my evidence which shows the results of our riparian survey. And the extent of fencing that has already been achieved. I think that clearly shows that there's been a significant effort in fencing waterways, and particularly on dairy farms, which tend to be on lower slope or more lowland areas, which absolutely is easier to fence. And just having dairy cattle, it's easier to fence a waterway effectively than, as we've mentioned, around having different stock types, deer, cattle, sheep. But what that survey shows is that there's a lot more work to be done to exclude stock from waterways on dry stock farms. So there's still quite a significant proportion of waterways on dry stock farms that are unfenced. Now, as has already been covered, there are practical limitations on fencing in hill country, and that has to be considered. But stock exclusion should be a number one consideration for farmers if they haven't done that already, simply because of the impacts that stock direct access can have on those waterways. So that's where I would essentially say number one priority, get your stock out of your waterways where it's practicable to do so, or have other methods to do that. And then I would look to focus attention on what we call critical source areas. So tracks, raceways, sheep camps, other areas where animals might have concentrated or the contaminants might be concentrated in the landscape.
Okay. I understand your answer, but there are costs involved in providing the other solutions as well. And
yes.
So I'm not sure that we've got a sufficient Section 32AA basis for making decisions on this, because the length I'm aware of the council's economic modelling, but my understanding of that was that there were not significant costs included for fencing. I'll check that with the relevant witnesses. And the sheer length of fencing required, I haven't seen any evidence to say that the $500 million is compensated for by benefits. So that's a challenge, and if parties can help us on that, I think that would be quite useful. In terms of setbacks from lakes and wetlands, is there a clear definition of where those setbacks should start from? For example, in terms of a lake, is it the median perimeter, or is it the low or the high level? Is that defined anywhere?
What makes it a difference? It was a topic of conversation in the technical course in both wetlands and lakes topics. Our joint understanding was that it wasn't clearly defined. It was that question of where do you measure the edge of the lake from? As we said, with a stream channel, it's usually reasonably clear where that demarcation is as to what's part of the stream channel and what's not. There was, I think Dr. Stewart from Department of Conservation had done some work looking at the extent based on the maximum lake level, and obviously at its maximum level some lakes will essentially flood out onto surrounding areas of land, and so there's a recognition that that there is a fuzzy boundary between the land and the lake itself. Also a fuzzy boundary between the wetland, between where a wetland ends and a lake begins. So I'm afraid, Commissioner, that doesn't help you very much. It's often a very fuzzy boundary.
Mm. But you don't want fuzzy boundaries in plans, but you just lose your arguments all the way through.
Yeah.
Okay, well, at least you've explained it. That's good. Now, you've talked about the changes in water quality between 2010-14 and 2018-2022, and you explained it wasn't understood. Has your thinking advanced since then, or is it still unclear as to what those changes might have been caused by?
No, I think we've had some discussions still along the lines of generating some hypotheses of what might be causing the increases, and one of the hypotheses is that as we have fenced off more and more of our waterways and planted more and more of our waterways, riparian areas, we shade those waterways, and the die-off of E. coli, essentially sunlight, is a very good disinfecting agent. So one of the hypotheses we'd like to progress is, are those areas that we've seen increase in E. coli in, could that increased stream shade be a factor in the increases? So now we're seeing, the sources are reasonably constant, but we've actually reduced the potential sunlight disinfection. So that's one potential hypothesis.
I think you did mention that the possibility of climate was also an issue. I've seen it in the evidence somewhere.
Yes.
But certainly at Tewa Karapu, there's a 5-year period of decreasing rainfall, and there were increasing nitrate concentrations.
Yes.
And similarly, when there was a period of less rainfall, there were decreasing nitrate concentrations. Very, very clear.
Yep.
So is that something that you think might be?
It is. I think the NIWA study that we contracted them to do to look into those trends, they did look at climate as a potential driver and couldn't draw that link very strongly. But it may be that, perhaps it was a more of a longer-term climate cycle that they hadn't been looking
at. Just briefly returning to wetlands, where does the 50 square metre area suggestion come from?
I'm unsure of that. It's probably a question for Mr. Trebelko. I do remember conversations with him around that, the difference between the 500 square metre, which is identified in the NPS, and 50 square metres. The conversation was around the potential values associated with wetlands, those very small wetlands. And in my view, I said to Mr. Trebelka that I consider that even very small wetlands are likely to have significant values in the landscape. I certainly consider, as Mr. Matheson pointed out, that 50 square metres is a very, very small area in the landscape.
Yeah, and this is probably a question for Mr. Trebelka as well, is if there are tens of thousands of these small wetlands, where's the Section 32A analysis to demonstrate that it's the most efficient and effective way of achieving the objectives? And so, Mr. Trebelko, if you're here, perhaps you take notice of that, please. And in terms of Wairaki Pastoral, with its multi-faceted operations, how do you see that being addressed through a consent process in terms of managing different elements of it, because you could well have three or four different nitrogen risks systems in place. Have you given any thought to how that would be consented?
I haven't, Commissioner. No,
I'm sorry. No, that's fine. And just a following up on your discussion with Horticultural New Zealand about effects of nitrogen, a couple of things. In two cases that I've been involved in on wastewater in the Manawatu Wanganui district, this issue came up. We're only a small discharger, so why should we have to do much? And the court's decision included this, and I put it on the table because I think it's relevant to this case. In the court's view, it is not an appropriate position for decision makers to take the view that because the majority of overallocation is caused by others, an individual contributor has no responsibility for contributing to a reduction in overallocation. Such a position is untenable, as effectively it could prevent or significantly extend the period over which the health of the receiving environment could be restored. So the court has made it very clear in those cases what its expectations are that all people contribute, rather than just the bigger players. So I put that out there because it's relevant to the discussion we had this morning. And following on from that, I was quite interested to see the evidence of Horticultural New Zealand with witnesses saying there will be negligible effects on the lower Waikato FMU. I would have thought that could potentially be the case at a global scale, but locally there could well be significant localised effects from increase. So do you have a view on that, please?
That was the view that I put forward, yes, and my evidence is that intensification, if that intensification is concentrated in certain areas, you run the risk of significant localised impacts. So you could have significant local impacts, even if the global effects are very small.
Thank you. Just a few to go now. In terms of the mitigation, offsetting and compensation provisions, how practical do you consider it would be for a consenting officer to decide how many CFU per 100 millilitres was equivalent to 2 grams per cubic metre of nitrogen, for example? How do you see that being dealt with in practice?
That wouldn't be my, in terms of the consenting, that's not my area of expertise, Commissioner, but I think it's, from a technical perspective, the expert caucus have identified that all 4 contaminants are important, and obviously in terms of the values, the different contaminants might affect different values. I hadn't come across the idea that mitigation of one contaminant might offset another contaminant. That's sort of a new concept for me.
It was to me, and that's why I'm asking the questions about it. So, basically, is the scientific advice that that should not be allowed?
From a technical perspective, increase in any of the contaminants is likely to have effects on the river and lead to us not achieving the long-term targets. So
I think that's clear.
Yes,
fine. Thank you. In terms of the Fongamarino wetland FMU, do you see any disadvantages in the court requiring that to become an FMU?
I think that and I'm sure Mr. Trevilco will be able to cover this in some detail, but my understanding is that if something is designated an FMU, you follow through the National Objectives Framework process, which involves identifying appropriate values, attributes, targets, etc. And I guess my main question is, have we done that for the Fongamarino FMU in PC1, or would designation of Fongamarino as an FMU require additional work to fill out those steps?
Okay, and just one last I guess comment almost on the issue of definition of lake catchment boundaries. This has been an issue in other cases, and it was dealt with simply by the council having a GIS layer or something where people could go to.
Yes.
And that's my understanding of what you're proposing to do, is that correct?
It is, yes. So in generating map 3.1, that GIS layer includes the boundaries of those lake catchments. So, but it's just a matter of making that GIS layer available publicly.
Thank you for your patience and for the clarity of your answer. Very helpful. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. I'm relieved that Justin Hogan has probably covered most of the questions that I would want to ask. Just turning to paragraph 100 and of your evidence in chief, which has got the graph that shows the fact that E-coli didn't behave itself between 2018 and 2022 in prison. You note there that there have been significant changes between these 2 periods. Your use of the word significant, is that scientific? Is it statistically based? Is there a statistically significant difference here?
Sorry, Commissioner, in relation to, I'm just wondering, whereabouts was the word significant that you're referring to?
4th word in paragraph 100. There have been significant changes.
Yes, so that is statistically significant. So there's been a statistically significant increase in E. coli. And if you look at the...
Yeah, it looks like it.
Yes, so you can see the boxes are all above that 0 line. So the interquartile range is what makes up those boxes.
Yep.
The fact that all of the boxes are above the zero line is indicative of a general deterioration.
You know, elsewhere in the evidence you say that, you know, stock exclusion from waterways is universally good practice. But this data doesn't seem to support that, does it?
It's surprising that given the extent of work we know has gone on across the primary sector, it's disappointing to not see improvements. And considering how far we have to go to even achieve swimmability in most parts of the catchment, it is a concern that, you know, unless we understand why and how we might turn that around, that is a significant science concern. That's something we need to address.
I imagine it makes it difficult in terms of stakeholder engagement. You know, farmers in particular go ahead and do all this work, and then the not unreasonable expectation that there will be improvements and
yes.
They don't occur. That must be a difficult, you know, problem to handle in terms of the way in which you engage with your stakeholders.
It is. I mean, primarily what we're asking for is people to change their behaviours, change their practice to achieve better water quality outcomes that the community is asking for. And we hope to be able to show them the evidence that that is in fact the case. And so, as I say, this is what the data shows, but it's disappointing that it doesn't give us a clearer picture.
So you asked NIWA to look into this, and they couldn't find an answer. Has the Regional Council considered actually doing some sort of experimental work with that more direct measuring of the contaminant runoff from slopes that makes it into the adjacent streams?
What we have looked at is, what we would like to do is to link the riparian survey information to the water quality monitoring. To say, so these are the areas, because we now have 20 years of riparian surveys every 5 years, to link the riparian survey information, because it's we know where that is, and we know that those changes are, to the water quality monitoring site. So do essentially a link between those two sources of information to say, you know, what are we seeing at those locations where we know there's been significant improvements in stock exclusion and planting. Often when people have reviewed the effects of riparian planting, for example, the benefits can be relatively mixed in terms of some things getting better, some things getting worse.
Ephemeral, intermittent, perennial streams. So if my understanding is correct, the PC1 proposes to address intermittent and perennial streams, both for stock exclusion and setback. Some appellants are interested in ephemeral streams as well being included in that. What's your view of whether ephemeral streams need to come into the picture as well?
What happens in the catchment obviously has a direct influence on what ends up in the stream. And the stream network reaches out into the catchment until such point as
essentially they merge together. So going from a perennial stream to an intermittent stream, ephemeral, and then you go into seepages and wetlands and swales and just the general landscape. There is a point, and notwithstanding that, obviously those headwater areas are likely to be generating a lot of the contaminants. There is a practical limitation on particularly on stock exclusion and fencing of those waterways. So I think PC1 is looking to be more, essentially go further in terms of those stock exclusion and going into having fencing requirements of intermittent waterways even when they're not carrying water. That's going further and is likely to have benefits. But to go even further out into ephemeral waterways, which are very much intermingled with the landscape, I think that would be very, very difficult and practical.
And on the ground, I'm a farmer and I need to go and fence my intermittent streams. How can I tell that a stream is an intermittent stream and not an ephemeral stream? Perennial to intermittent is probably a bit easier, but perennials climb all the time. But how do you, on the ground, how does that get operationalised?
Yes, there is a real challenge, and that is something one of our scientists is working on at the moment, is around those definitions. And I understand Auckland Council has got some quite useful definitions around ephemeral, intermittent, permanent. Intermittent streams will have a clearly defined channel and will have a substrate, a stream substrate without vegetation cover. Whereas ephemeral channels, because they only flow immediately during and after rainfall, are much more likely just to have unsorted or just not clearly defined and in size channels and don't necessarily have stream type substrate in them. But I recognise that it is going to be a challenge for those on the land to determine what is or isn't. And so in many ways the old greater than 1 metre and deeper than a red band was quite simple and practical for people on the land to understand. But we're looking to go further in terms of protecting waterways.
Right, okay, well thank you for that. And one last question. You talk about the in your view, the need for flexibility regarding the stock exclusion. Difficulties that you've expressed. That flexibility, is it provided for in the way in which where do you see that flexibility being provided for in the way the Schedule C is written or rules? I'm not 100% certain where I find it, but how do we know that, or how does a user know that there is that? There's potentially some flexibility involved here.
My understanding, and maybe that Mr. Trevelco can probably hear one of the others, but my understanding is that if farms aren't able to comply with the requirements, they can seek a consent, and then they would identify through a farm plan how they were going to deal with areas, so essentially that flexibility becomes part of the farm plan as a result of the consenting process. That's my understanding, but we need to check that. But
I know that's simple, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Scarsbrook. I just have one question which follows on from something Commissioner Maven asked you about E. coli. And I appreciate that NIWA were sent in to investigate potential causes, and I don't know if you're familiar with the results that they did. But as well as sitting in this court, I also sit in the district court, and I hear prosecutions under the Resource Management Act, and I hear a large number of prosecutions in relation to effluent discharges. And I read what you say about improvements in dairy effluent disposal practices. And I think generally the state of the art has improved, but there are still some significant events that occur. But what I don't have an understanding of is the extent to which possibly those events might have an impact on your statistics, or whether in fact, you know, because they'd be widespread and thankfully relatively, I believe, infrequent. But I just wonder whether or not your compliance officers were involved in discussions about what they were observing at that end of the system, and whether or not that might be a factor.
That's a good observation, and Mr. Sinclair in his directorate, he has the compliance and enforcement teams who are directly involved in those district court matters. So he may be able to shed light on that.
Well,
it's an interesting.
I mean, obviously, one of the things about statistics is what focus are you bringing to bear on the data. Is this an overall summary of all of your testing stations throughout the catchment, or is it localised testing that might be affected by localised events?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, well, I'll follow that up with that simply. Thank you very much. Anything arising from the court's questions? No. Oh, sorry.
I'm really sorry. There was one matter.
Go ahead.
I know it's the worst thing to do to everyone before a cup of tea, but there was just one matter, Doctor. It was suggested to you that it's not tenable for the small discharges to do nothing. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Yes. And you're aware, aren't you, that at least in the case of commercial vegetable growers, big or small, there's a wide range of controls on them, isn't there? Well, they have to apply for resource consent in every instance, don't they?
Sorry, in our current regional plan?
Well, under PC1, the situation under what would be the case under PC1, they'll have to apply for a resource consent in every case, right?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. And comply with all the conditions of that consent.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Prepare FEPs.
Yes.
Review them as necessary.
Yes.
And in fact, it's the more stringent type of FEP that they have to comply with, isn't it?
More stringent than
the Schedule D2 one, rather than the D1 one.
Sorry, I don't know the level of D2.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's fine. And do you know that Horticulture NZ promotes a code of practice for nutrient management?
Yes, and has done for many years, I understand.
Yes, and that's a type of, and in addition, there's a type of certification, isn't there, called the New Zealand Good Agricultural Practice, or GAP.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's another thing that's promoted for growers, isn't it?
Yes.
And so would you agree that at least in the case of commercial vegetable growers, they're certainly not in a category of small discharges who are promoting that nothing at all needs to be done by them? Agree with that?
I think the horticulture industry has done a lot of work to address the contaminant losses from growers, and I think growers have probably improved dramatically in practice.
Yeah, thank you. That is all I have, Your Honour. Commissioner, thank you.
Very good. All right. We'll take the adjournment now for 15 minutes. You're